This is we welcome Zach Fiesel to Boxed Wine and Witchcraft. And Zach, you are presenting to us today the mysticism in Buddhism. And that's a nice, fun, rhymy, tongue-twisting title. I will admit I practiced that a couple times earlier today, so I wouldn't garble it up too much. Now, you are actually, you're in training for Buddhism, correct?
Yes.
So how long, what prompted your interest?
So, actually, this would be a great way to talk, to start going into it, I guess. When I was much younger, studying the world religions, as a lot of people who end up in spiritual circles do, one of the things that I came across was not just Buddhism, but the various sects of Buddhism. Very much how, so you have Christianity, but you have Protestantism and Catholicism, and then those break down even further. You have Buddhism, and then you have Tibetan Buddhism, Japanese Buddhism, Zen, Chan, etc. Tibetan Buddhism was more or less the type of Buddhism that I liked the most when I was younger because of how ritualized it is, and I love doing ritual. And there's purposes for that, especially in Tibetan Buddhism. So in Tibetan Buddhism, it's also called Vajrayana Buddhism, and Vajrayana Buddhism also has different types of schools in primarily China, Japan, and Tibet. But in Vajrayana Buddhism, as it's practiced in Tibet, the Vajrayana uses many different skills and ways to reach enlightenment. And the use of rituals is very heavy. So in going through the different items used in Tibetan Buddhism, I came across what was called a namka. Now, namka are very similar to what we call here in the West, God's eyes, and most people who, you know, make them in elementary school or whatever are told they are a Mexican amulet or a Mexican representation of a deity, and that is true. That same kind of concept exists in Tibetan Buddhism. A namka is a support for a deity, as well as a magical type of charm. Padmasambhava, who is also called Guru Rinpoche, when he brought the first iteration of Buddhism into Tibet, had a lot of obstacles. And the way he tamed them, we translate it as obstacles in the more contemporary era. In the modern world, what you'll see, like English-based texts on what it was like living in the Himalayas, they will say demon a lot of the time. And there are all kinds of obstacles in Tibetan Buddhism. You have duds, duns, they're called lu in Tibetan Buddhism. They're called nagas in Sanskrit. They're a being, they can be a demon. Yakshas, they can be a demon. Zen spirits, they can be demons. So it all just gets lumped together in this category of demon when it's actually a lot more specific than that. But Padmasambhava encountered a bunch of these demons, these obstacles, and he had to remove them. So he wove together this thread cross, and using a vajra, which is another implement in Tibetan Buddhism, a purva. He used a purva. He conquered, or a lot of Tibetan Buddhists would rather say didn't conquer so much as he persuaded them to either leave the place by satisfying them or by making them dharma protectors. So these vicious, angry, malevolent beings became our friends. They became helpers along the path. And they protect Tibet as a nation. They protect the practitioners. They protect monasteries. When you get into the higher levels of yoga and Tibetan Buddhism, you're allowed to work with them. In my personal lineage, we have Mahakala Bernakchen, who is the great black cloaked one. But again, you can only practice with them after going through Nundro, which are the preliminary practices, etc. But finding out what a namka is, was really interesting to me, because not only were they used for that, to trap things, they're used to balance a person's astrology, their quote-unquote destiny. I don't prefer that term, but again, issues with languages and translation. So that always was in the back of my head. I would love to have a Namka constructed for myself. Okay, so I was about 10, 12 years old, cut to 2019. One night, I decided to Google Namka just to see if something came up around me. And I found one practitioner, and she lives in Prague. I went to her website, and it talked about her lineage. She received the transmission to practice Namka by Namka Norbu Rinpoche, who actually passed, I believe, in 2018 or 16, I'm not sure. He passed, and she took up this practice of wanting to accomplish, at that time, 108 Namkas. 108 is a very sacred, very special, very powerful, very auspicious number in Tibetan Buddhism. For those who practice any kind of Buddhism, you are often given or use a mala, and that mala has 108 beads, not counting the guru bead. So she went on this endeavor of making 108 namkas. The namka that I ordered actually wasn't for myself, was part of that 108. The namka that I ordered after going through like her practices, I saw Medicine Buddha. And from that, I contacted her. We talked a little bit about what my goals and everything were. She created this Namka of Medicine Buddha based on a mandala of Medicine Buddha. And I now actually own three Namkas by her. After discovering the practice of Medicine Buddha, I liked it enough to be like, okay, I want to do this practice. How do I start? So after briefly talking with her how she started, I looked around my area for Buddhist centers. The only one that got a hold of me was Columbus KTC. KTC stands for Karma Teksum Choling. We are one of the centers whose main monastery is in Woodstock, New York. It is the United States seat of the 17th Gyalwan Karmapa, Ogyen Trinley Dorje. That is known as the Karma Triana Dharma Chakra. That is Sanskrit. Karma Teksum Choling is the same thing, it's just in Tibetan. To break down the meaning, so karma means action, triana means three vehicle, and Dharma Chakra is a Dharma wheel, the eight-spoked wheel that you often see as the symbol for Buddhism. But it means the action of Dharma by the use of the three vehicles, the Hinayana, which is also known as Theravada, the Mahayana, and the Vajrayana. But after contacting Columbus KTC, after contacting my teacher, who at that time was the resident teacher, we've since gotten, I don't want to say we've gotten two more, we've gotten one more. The other teacher just primarily works with the KKSG, the Karma Kagyu study group in Athens. But at the time it was just Lama Kathy, and I contacted her and we set up what is called Refuge. And the Refuge vow is the first vow you would take when entering Buddhism. It is claiming Buddha as the teacher, the Dharma as the path, and the Sangha as the community that helps you realize that path. Your first step into Buddhism will be taking refuge, very similar to your first step into Catholicism would be your baptism. And if anyone who's ever studied Catholicism knows, there are, I believe, 7 or 9 sacraments. And in Buddhism, there are different vows that you will take along the path. You start with refuge, then it's the bodhisattva. If you want to go even further, you have the precepts, the pratimoksha vows. If you get high enough, you get to the vajrayana precepts, the vajrayana vows. I just took refuge and I've been doing this. I shouldn't say doing this. I've been practicing the Dharma since June of 2019. So my, I guess, beginnings of all this started with a thread cross.
That's quite a journey. Yeah. Now, when you say ritual, like, how is possibly a Buddhist ritual different from a Wiccan ritual, a witchcraft ritual, Catholicism ritual? Are they similar yet different?
They are both. They are very similar. It depends on what level of ritual you're doing. So as someone as, I guess, low on the totem pole as I am, I've only taken the refuge vow. There are only certain things that I can do. Mm-hmm. Like I said, when you get to the higher levels of Tantra, and of the yogas, you have Charya Yoga, Kriya Yoga, Anuttara Yoga, Ati Yoga, and Dzogchen. There are certain things you can do, there are certain things you can't do. And a good chunk of this, of the ritual, is influenced by Bun. Now, Bun in Buddhism, they say Bun came, it was the indigenous religion of Tibet. Others very much are like, no, Bun came up with Buddhism as it entered Tibet. There's a lot of conflict on who came first, who influenced who.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the Bun rituals went into Tibetan Buddhism. And so things like song offering, which was the first ritual that I myself can do by myself. There are certain rituals where it can only be done in a group, or it can only be done with a Vajra master or a Lama leading the group. Song is the offering of smoke.
Okay.
It is the practice that I do is a, although I am a Karmakaju practitioner, a lot of our practices come from Nyingma, which was the first transmission of Buddhism into Tibet. So you have the Nyingma school, the Sakya and Kagyu came up both around the 11th century. So they're kind of contemporary. And then you have the Gelug school, which the Dalai Lama belongs to, that came up after. The practices that I can do in the Kagyu lineage, again, are more or less, I don't want to say anyone can do them, but it's not harmful so much that if you did do it, something bad would happen. I am not a Lama, so I can't really talk a whole lot about who's allowed to do what. Mm-hmm. But the practice of song is just the burning of smoke to clear obstacles. And our practice of that is called the Ryuo Sangchu. Which is the mountain cleansing offering or the offering of smoke on the mountainside. There are different translations for it. It is a Nyingma practice, but you just burn fragrant things. You burn medicines. You burn, and what I mean by medicines are things like the tripala, aru, baru, charu, which are very rare to find around here. You can burn clove, you can burn cinnamon, you can burn things that we in the West consider medicines in traditional, like European herbal medicine, such as mints and rosemary and, you know, the various fragrant herbs that we use. Burning these things removes obstacles. There's a second type of ritual that you can do, which is the burning of sur, which appeases those in the bardo or the in-between state between death and your rebirth. It appeases certain hungry ghosts. The song more or less removes obstacles. It pleases the local deities, it pleases the gods of the area, it pleases the land spirits. The third type of fire ritual only a Lama can do, and that's called Jinsen. And I would have to undergo 3-year retreat and everything before I would even think about doing Jinsen.
Now, would you say the smoking ritual, is that some ways comparable to like the smudging?
Yes.
That, like, okay.
And in fact, okay, so most Native Americans, or most people are familiar with Native Americans burning sage to clear things. In Tibet, there is a specific type of sage, and I can't remember its name right now, but it is used not only during most song practices along with juniper, but especially on Zamling Chisang, which is a prayer festival. I want to say it's called Ganden Kiempa or Ganden Chimpa, something like that. But it is a very specific native type of sage that clears obstacles. And most people will either, if they can't get a hold of juniper, they'll try to get a hold of that. But yes, it is very similar in smudging. It's similar in the burning of frankincense in the Catholic Church. It's similar to Bahur and Ud in Islam.
Okay. So a lot of similarities for, you know, similar workings, just different scents.
Yep.
Now, I know you you mentioned like the malas and the prayer beads, and I wonder, like, is there similarity like from a prayer mala, the 108 beaded, to like a rosary? Because rosaries are now becoming like the what do they call them, like the Christian witches. You know, is that something that's similar that can be used in a magical working?
Yes. So usually when one talks about a mala is useless without its actual prayer. And those prayers are mantras. Now, there are certain mantras that anyone can do that I can talk about without being a lama, because it's just so broad and exists in the sutras, and there's other, you know, technicalities I could go into. But Om Mani Padme Hum, or Om Mani Padme Hung, first one is Sanskrit, the second one is Tibetan, slight difference. That is the mantra of Avalokiteshvara, or in Tibet, Chenrezig. He is the Bodhisattva of compassion. That mantra can be said by anyone for any need, protection, abundance, money, etc. The mala itself can be protective, especially if a master or a high lama, a Rinpoche, or even a Kempo, has blessed it. When I had my mala, originally, it was blessed at my refuge ceremony with my teacher. I used it in my first retreat, which is a 3-day-long retreat called the Nyunye Retreat. It had a white tassel, and we were given Amrit, which is in Tibetan Buddhism, contemporary Tibetan Buddhism. It is a blessed sacred water with, it's just water and saffron.
Mm-hmm.
And we, at the end of retreat, get to take some of that home with us. So I had it in a bottle that I brought, and I dipped the ends of that into that water, and it stained the ends a yellowish orange.
Okay.
Because of all of the blessings of my teacher, the blessings that it was present at my refuge, the blessings of it being touched to a Buddha image, the blessings of the Lama who was there teaching us how to do Nyunye, the practice of it being present while the Nyunye Sadhana was done, the blessing of the saffron water, you know, the blessing of the thousands of mantras we did in that 3 days on that mala gave it a certain power. Eventually, the string started getting warped and ruined, so I had to restring it. So it doesn't carry as many blessings as it once did because it was physically destroyed at some point in order for me to restring it. But I now carry on that mala what are called sungor, which are little charms that are a type of, it's just paper really folded up, and printed on that paper is the mandala of the deity, whatever deity you wish to have a sungor made of, or whatever sungor you wish to purchase. And it is then wrapped with string in a very elaborate geometric shape. And most of the times, these are just going to be bare. The ones I have are plastic covered. Some do come in pouches. But that charm on that mala gives it a type of protection as well. So like if you had one for Tara, if you carried a Tara Sunghor on your mala, she helps with removing obstacles. She comes quickly to the aid of anyone. She's known as the Swift One. If you have Medicine Buddha on your mala, and they don't necessarily have to be Sunghors, they could be little impressed amulets of metal. Sometimes they're called gao. They're also called something else. I can't think of what they are right now. Gao are usually more specific to little tubes that you can fill, or little reliquaries that you fill with song substance, like I talked about earlier, with blessing pills, with sacred earth. But having that on your mala, it's not like wearing a chain with a medal. It is wearing something sacred on something that is already sacred. So it's kind of like you're compounding energies there.
So it is like a level up in a way.
Yeah.
It's not like it just kind of gets lost of what's already there. It does add to.
Yeah.
Interesting. Because I know like we've carried malas and people have asked, and, you know, and I know the work of the prayer, the mantra work, but to know that there can be so much more into a mala and the work that can kind of, not kind of, that does go into it when you know what you're doing. Mm-hmm. I know I have used rosary. I still use rosary beads in my healing mesa, which is, you know, a Southern shamanic tradition, but it works for me. So speaking of, I know you have a couple of other traditional practices that you do outside of Buddhism. Do you find that it's contradictory to be studying Buddhism but offer yampayas?
Yes. there is a saying by Ram Dass, which I only know because I believe my teacher, either she was telling me about it one time during one of our, they're called interviews. They're just where you sit with your teacher and ask questions of whatever comes up. Or it was on one of the Sunday talks that she does. The quote was something along the lines of, I found my path by combining a little bit of everything, but I don't suggest that for anyone.
Mm.
And I feel like I'm kind of doing that. So I don't suggest, again, nor do I condone doing this, nor do I think that this is a personal philosophy that lacks any flaw. What I do, on one hand, very much contradicts what are Buddhist ethics on the other. So, before I even get into that, in Buddhism, you have, like I mentioned earlier, the Hinayana, the Mahayana, and the Vajrayana. The Hinayana, which I prefer to call Theravada, because Hinayana literally translated means lesser or smaller vehicle, and those in Laos, Cambodia, Thailand, the type of Buddhism they practice is Theravada. Theravada is the more appropriate, less derogatory term for the Hinayana. So out of respect for that tradition, I'll be referring to it as Theravada. In Theravada Buddhism, that motivation is to save oneself from samsara, which is cyclic existence, constantly reincarnating uncontrollably into these six realms of existence. The six realms being hell beings, hungry ghosts, animals, humans, heroes, and gods. The idea is to escape all that. In the Mahayana vehicle, in those traditions, those of what's mostly practiced in Japan, China, and Korea, it is the salvation of self from samsara, as well as everyone else. You try to attain enlightenment to consciously reincarnate as a human to help others get out of samsara. In the Vajrayana, and there is some debate on whether the Vajrayana is just a subsect of Mahayana or if it's its own practice. In the Vajrayana, we try to save ourselves, save as many as possible, but do it as quickly as we can. Hmm. Now, I don't want anyone to get confused. When I say save others, I don't mean proselytizing. I don't mean telling people you're going to hell. I don't mean you're going to constantly be suffering if we don't get out of here. We don't do that. There are specific words of Buddha where he said, do not go out and try to get people to believe in all of this. With trying to achieve these three levels in an instant, which it's said can be done, that's what Vajrayana is said to do, to in one lifetime achieve enlightenment. In trying to just develop the Mahayana motivation myself, it is very difficult. People annoy me very quickly. It is hard to have what is called bodhicitta, the motivation to see everyone's primordial Buddha nature and to see their unflawed existence. It is hard to look at someone who is very arguently against certain rights of certain people and still find unfathomable compassion for them. And that's just one of the illusions that we have, you know, because we clutch to reality and, you know, we try to work on detachment and curing the poisons. That, again, I could go on and on with that. But right now, I've kind of decided I can have bodhicitta as much as I'm able to. Mm-hmm. It's always said in Vajrayana, don't lose bodhicitta. The minute you lose any grasp of bodhicitta is the minute you're in danger. So I can practice the Mahayana aspect of bodhicitta while still focusing on the Theravada aspect of just getting the hell out of here. Understanding that I am, because I'm not, you know, doing everything I could or should be doing, I'm going to reincarnate. I'm going to come back no matter what. So on the other hand of my practice, a lot of people ask, they don't really ask me to do it so much as they ask me about like what my position is on cursing. One of the five precepts that people will take, one, if not a few, some will take all, usually it's just one, of the five precepts during the refuge ceremony, I didn't take any. One of them is to cause no harm to any living being in any way, including magical. Studying brujeria and practicing brujeria and studying and practicing conjure, those traditions came out of oppressed people. Those curses were meant to subdue their own obstacles so they could have a better life. So those curses still exist. We don't use them the same as they did back in the day. We use them for more contemporary problems. Back in the day, you would get a woman to leave or for her to be angry at your man, because a woman back in that time really only could survive if she had a male partner. Now we use that same working just because someone is jealous of someone else. There's not really a goal there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if someone were to come to me, actually, I have had clients come to me recently who are in situations where they're trying to get rid of their own person living with them, significant other, whatever you want to say. The ways of doing that are not in line with Buddhist ethics. But I am not about to tell my client, I'm going to do Buddhist practices of love and compassion, and you have to take the bullshit so in a better life you can reincarnate again as a human and not go backward into the animal realm. No. You're being abused. I'm going to try and get you out of that abusive situation in the way that I can. And that might just come from the fact that it is very similar to the people who are all love and light, and how much I can't stand that sentiment that this is your karma. You chose to do this. You have to deal with it. No, that in its own right can be abusive. Mm-hmm. So again, I'm not going to say to them, well, I can pray and do the Chen Rezig Sadhana for you, and maybe that'll help. No, I've tried other methods. They have had success. And if that is the one I know is going to work, that's what I'm going to do. Aside from the fact that I don't have the empowerment to do Tara to help get others out of situations like that. I don't have the empowerment to do the Chen Rezig Sadhana with such full force and effect that it moves them out of there. I don't have the preliminary necessary just to go to Mahakala or the other protectors and get her out of that situation.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what kind of is problematic when you practice both of these things, is you're going to infringe on the benefits of Buddhism, but Buddhism is classed in such a way that if I had a monastery or a community of lamas just up the road, I could ask them on her behalf to do things magically to get her out of that situation. We don't have that. We don't have lay practitioners in this area. I don't have a Nakpa that I could go to. I don't have a Repa that I could go to. I don't have a lama that I could go to for that in this area. I have saints. I have hair from the individuals. I have dirt from where they live, and I have chili peppers. That is accessible. That I can do.
Mm-hmm. Now, would you ever go ahead and take those six vows?
The precepts?
Yeah.
No. The problem with that is there are maybe one or another that I could probably take and hold. The idea when taking those is to take the one that's going to give you the most change in your life. Mm-hmm. There is one vow that I forget exactly what it is. There is one precept that you can take, and it covers kind of the other four. But when you take that vow, if you give that precept back, and I'm not entirely sure that you can or can't, usually when you give vows back, you receive the positive karma of keeping it for that long up until that point. If you break the five precepts, it is very bad karma. The five precepts come from the Vinaya, which are part of the Theravada tradition. You can't take them again. Mm-hmm. Once you take it and you break it, you can't take it again in this lifetime. It is a very, there are a lot of vows actually that if you break or abandon, have very significant karmic consequences.
These are pretty strict and sturdy religious concepts here.
They are very, that's another thing. A lot of people don't understand. Again, it's toxic when Westerners view Eastern philosophy the way we have, because it creates this idea of, again, love and light. It creates this idea of everything will be fine.
Mm-hmm.
And they kind of gloss over the fact that it requires discipline. If I do take any empowerments, I enter what is called samaya, which is this connection between teacher and student. It's also a connection between you and the deity or the practice that you're doing. And there are certain obligations that you take up when you do it. Sometimes they're implied, sometimes they're given to you specifically by the teacher. I remember watching the Karmapa. A lot of the empowerments that the Karmapa gives are on YouTube. The one he gave with Akshobhya, he asked, he started talking about commitments. He goes, I think the best thing to ask of you all is, anytime you notice yourself getting angry, do something to stop it. Akshobhya's kind of main domain is transforming anger into mirror-like wisdom. So he gave them the samaya. One of the samaya expectations was, if you find yourself getting angry, stop and find a way to change it right then and there. Others will give you certain amounts of recitations you should do. Again, it's going to be debated. If you stop doing those recitations, some people will say, just start where you left off and keep going. Mm-hmm. You have a long pause of months or even years. Others will say, once you stop on, you know, for so long, you've broken samaya and you have to undergo either full nundro again, or a part of nundro, or do vajrasattva practice, or do the nyunye retreat. So there are, what is the word? There's penance that has to be done with certain things.
Well, it's, I think there is the misconception in a way where a lot of people, I guess the Westerners, if you would say, view Buddhism as just, again, like that love and light, and everything is just, you know, sit back, relax, and be nice to people, and you're living in this Buddhist way. You know, there's a lot more structure, as you're letting us know, than what most people understand. You know,
there certainly is, and I've actually, to a few of my friends who've asked about it, I've broken it down in terms they can understand. It is very similarly structured to Catholicism. Mm-hmm. You have a head of lineage, which in Catholicism you have the Pope. For mm-hmm. our school specifically, you have the Karmapa. And then you have priests in Catholicism. We have the lamas, which are the teachers. You have those who are friars or brothers or associated with clergy, but they themselves are not clergy. We have the nakpas. We have the repas. Mm-hmm. You have, you know, the congregation. For us, that is our sangha. You have baptism and christening and confirmation. We have the refuge ceremony. We have the bodhisattva vow. You have penance and confession. We do penance and confession every day. There are different ways to do that. You can do it through guru yoga. You can do it through deity practice if you have certain deities. You can do it through confessing things directly to your teacher. You can do it through the seven branch prayer. You can dedicate the gewa, the Buddha, or the merit of the virtue that you accumulated in your practice, that is part of penance. You know, there are a lot of similarities in structure to Catholicism. And that is usually how I tell people it is. It is an Eastern structured version of how Catholicism is structured.
Now, when you say doing working with deities, I know a lot of pagan practitioners will use deities outside of, like, maybe their main, I guess, initiatory. So, I mean, how does that work in Buddhism if you see somebody who is not actively practicing Buddhist try to work with Tara, try to work with Medicine Buddha? Is that seen as disrespectful because they're not in Buddhist training?
A lama could definitely answer that question much more thoroughly than I can, but I can give you information based on just what I have figured out through my practice. Anyone can go and find these answers. It's typically agreed upon that what exists in the sutras are available for anyone to do. The deities that are mostly practiced in the beginning of going, or after you take refuge, then you're kind of introduced into the deities if you haven't been already. They're open to be practiced by anyone. Should you have taken refuge? Yes. But even if you haven't, you can practice these deities. Those would be Chenrezig or Avalokiteshvara, Tara, specifically Green Tara, mm-hmm. Medicine Buddha, Amitabha, and Manjushri. These ones have been in the sutras since the sutras were recorded. Technically, since they were spoken. That is another thing. The sutras are like the gospel. The gospels of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John were written after the events of the passion and life of Christ. Mm-hmm. The sutras were written after Siddhartha Gautama went into parinirvana. Most sutras, if not all, will start, "Thus have I heard," or "So have I heard it." meaning I have heard from another person, or I was present there and this is what I remember. They go into finishing the rest of the sutra of what happened. When you finish taking refuge, when you've gotten familiar with these deities, you can go and receive, in Tibetan Buddhism, you have Wang, Lung, and Tri. Wang is the empowerment. Lung is the transmission of the text, meaning someone who is a lineage holder of that practice goes through really quickly, reads the entire text to you, and then that energy, that Lung, enters your mind stream, enters your body, enters your speech, and you can then practice it.
Hmm.
And the tree is the how to do it. It's the instructions, the commentary. In that situation, and in those specific instances, you cannot practice them. You can practice Chenrezig's mantra. You could even go so far, some say, as to practice his sadhana, his, I guess, ritualized worship.
Okay.
By reading the text and doing that meditation practice. That is it. You're not going to get very far. The effectiveness of those practices comes from the empowerment. It comes from the teaching and hearing those words from a lineage holder who has a line of people who've gotten success and found enlightenment through this practice. And you have to have the guidance of the Sangha, the guidance of the Lama to get there. If I had not taken refuge, if I had not had a teacher, if I just one day decided to find a Tibetan store online that sold the sadhana of Chenrezig, I can do it. I can recite it. There's probably going to be more benefit than not to it, mm-hmm. but it's not going to benefit you to reaching enlightenment. The five deities that I mentioned, Tara, Chenrezig, Amitabha, Medicine Buddha, Manjushri, they're all bodhisattvas or Buddhas. They all exist to work for the benefit of every human. They are freely approachable. That is their job. Their job is to help every sentient being escape samsara, not one single being left behind. You can approach them. They will help you. You will not reach enlightenment, though.
So would you say this is similar to like when somebody finds like a pagan or Wiccan and they have to go through the year and the day, like to be brought in, to be taught, to be initiated, to be given that knowledge? You know, would you say that's equatable?
I would say it's similar. Yeah.
Okay.
I guess you could kind of say that the traditional year and a day for a Wiccan would be like our receiving the empowerment, receiving the Lung, receiving the instructions, and then going into retreat, practicing it, accomplishing it. And then we can use it to benefit others directly.
Now, what would you say are like the most important like tools in your schooling, in your training? You've mentioned mala. Like, are there other important things that you have to, or not maybe not have to, but you choose to work with, that you choose to keep yourself in that mode of learning and in that spiritual space?
There are a multitude of things that I have. So, like I said, I have the Namka. I now own three. So the first one, like I said, I went in wanting to get one for my personal astrology. I ended up getting the Medicine Buddha Mandala in the form of a Namka. I keep that on my shrine. Then my second one was my personal astrological composition made up to help balance any obstacles that I would encounter in my life. The third one I own is actually meant to be a support for when I do the rituals of Song and Sur, and when I receive them, I will be doing Chid and Chitor practices. But in those four practices, we call upon what are called the four guests. And so, like I said, Song deals mostly with the land spirits. Sor Dearsmouth deals mostly with those in the bardo. In Chud, it is the offering of the entire body as a feast to the four guests. And in Chittor, it is the offering of water to hungry ghosts. But we invoke all four guests to be present for all four of those rituals when we do them.
What are the four guests?
The four guests are, first, all enlightened beings. So all Yadams, which are our meditational deities, like the ones I mentioned, Tara, Medicine Buddha, Amitabha, etc. They're asked to be present, as well as the fully enlightened beings of Theravada, Mahayana, and Vajrayana. All enlightened beings. The second guest are the protectors. They're called Dharmapalas in Sanskrit. They're called, I can't remember what their name is at the moment, but they protect the Dharma. They protect the Dharma practitioners. Some of them are fully enlightened. Some of them are only partially enlightened. And that is another aspect of Vajrayana, is there are certain fierce deities that we are allowed to work with at certain levels, but if you do it wrong, it can have disastrous effects. So those beings are usually kept very concealed, very hidden away. Rarely would you ever get a glimpse of their image. They are kept secret and hidden. Then you have the third guest, which is us. Us and all of those beings in the six realms of existence. We have the people who we owe karmic debts to. We have the animals who we may have wronged in a past life. Tibetans love to say that every sentient being at one point or another was our mother in a past life. And so we should treat those beings as if they still are our mother. And the fourth guest are things such as obscurations, obstacles, karmic debts, hungry ghosts, things that will actively get in the way, demons, hell beings, etc., things that actively get in the way of you practicing Dharma.
Now, what I mean, I can kind of understand, but why would you invite so many higher beings, ascended, I guess, if you will, enlightened, as well as the lower beings to come in? Is it for the balancing?
That may be part of it. The reason that we ask them all to be present is because the offering is meant more or less for the lower two guests. The higher two guests, we do out of respect. They're enlightened, so I offer you this to help me reach enlightenment. You are a protector. I offer you this so that you can protect me. And then for the lower two, I see your pain and I am working on myself to get to enlightenment so I can help you reach enlightenment. Take this offering until I get there. And for the fourth being, you may be angry with me. I may have caused you harm. Take this as a peace offering. I am sorry. There's this idea in Buddhism that things that cause us harm, they just want something from us. Instead of fighting it, we give it something until it is satisfied. When it is satisfied, it leaves. Sutram Elioni actually published a book. It's called Feeding Your Demons, where she talks a lot about feeding, not fighting, as well as the practice of Chud. And if you go onto YouTube, she has many walkthroughs of how to do this. But you essentially take your personal demons, and instead of trying to fight against them, you give them whatever it is they're asking of you. If you're depressed, where does that depression come from? Feed it to that. It will go away. If you're angry, where does that anger come from? Give it what it's wanting. It will leave you alone. It's very contradictory to us in the West, where you know, if we feed the depression, it just gets stronger. If you feed the anger, it just gets stronger. In the East, it doesn't get stronger. It gets satisfied and it's finished and it leaves you alone.
Maybe the confusion could be like, what does it mean to feed?
When things attack us, like I said, they want something from us. They want something that they don't have. So for speaking psychologically, if I am an angry person, what is causing me anger? Other people. Okay. What is it that you have against other people? Mm-hmm. Oh, they're in a better position than me. Why does that bother you? Because it feels like I'm unsuccessful. Why do you see yourself as unsuccessful? Because I haven't done A, B, C, and D. What makes you think you have to do A, B, C, and D? Well, because that's what I was told. So you're constantly going through this this questioning and getting down to the very seed of why you're angry. And you just keep pouring and pouring and giving until you're down to that seed and that last question that resolves all of it.
So feeding for your tradition would be more of not necessarily continuing to be angry, but more of feeding it the attention.
Yeah.
Of finding out why.
Yes.
Which I think a lot of any healing tradition really is getting to the root of the problem.
Yeah.
Like put the Band-Aid on top, find out why, you know, you're seeing these surface area problems. But I could see where to say feeding, where somebody would say, well, how is that going to help? You're just exacerbating. Mm-hmm. But in reality, it's the action behind the word is slightly different.
Yeah. The other thing I definitely have to mention with this is it all is born out of compassion. So instead of seeing that demon or that obstacle or that obscuration as an enemy or a foe, you should at first see it as another suffering thing. Your anger is another suffering thing. Mm-hmm. Your anger very much is part of you. You know, it's not inseparable, you know, and I could get into the Heart Sutra and, you know, like I said, going down to the very root cause. Part of the Heart Sutra is you can tear things apart as many times as you want up into what you think is infinity. It will never exist in and of itself on its own. It is an aggregate of something. And then we could talk about, there's a lot of things I could go into with that, but it's not separable from you and it's not inseparable from you. It is part of you, but it can also be seen objectively. You think your anger is part of you and you think that it is part of your personality. And so it becomes part of your personality and it becomes a way you react. In Chud and in practices like the feeding your demons system that Sutra Malioni created, you see it outside of yourself and it makes it a little easier. Mm-hmm. And you look at it with compassion. You don't look at it as an enemy that you have to overcome. You don't think of it as an illness or a sickness that you have to medicate or go to therapy for or overcome. I am not in any way disparaging therapy or medication. I very much, yes, go do that if you need it. But in these practices, you look at it as compassion, as compassionately as possible. You look at it as another suffering being and ultimately as another suffering part of you. Mm-hmm. And attacking yourself isn't going to help the situation. Looking at yourself with compassion and helping that will help you. So again, compassion is a very big part of those practices. It's not just satiating them. It's satiating them out of compassion in order to achieve enlightenment, if that's what you're going through, or just to achieve a better you.
Mm-hmm. I like the idea and knowing and understanding better that Buddhism isn't just chanting mantras and wearing a mala you know, necklace or bracelet, that it's a lot of self-work. And I wonder how many people, you know, don't necessarily realize the amount of discipline and self-work would go into if they were thinking of going into a Buddhist practice. So that being said, if somebody were to come up to you and say, hey, I'm thinking to, you know, of getting into Buddhism, I have, you know, some background in XYZ, you know, regardless of what the background is, what's like that one thing that you would want them to know?
I don't think it's so much what I'd want them to know. If they were to come up to me and say, I'm thinking about getting into Buddhism, what's your advice? I would say, go look up the Four Noble Truths, go look up the Eightfold Path. And if you live your life like that, you're already a Buddhist. And the funny thing is, the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, are basic ethical requirements of any religion. Anyone who actually follows those are a practicing Buddhist in a technical way.
Mm.
There is a book called What Makes You Not a Buddhist by Dzongsar Jamyang Khyentse. And in the first chapter, he actually says, you're a Buddhist if you follow these four things. And I don't exactly remember what those four things were, but they are summed up in what my teacher shortens to say are the four sayings of the Buddha. They're much longer than what I'm about to tell you, but this is how my teacher tells me. Do no harm, practice virtue, tame your mind. These are the sayings of the Buddha. I feel like if you follow those along with the Eightfold Path and along with the Four Noble Truths, which my teacher has also said, those two things, the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, are summed up in those four lines. Do no harm, practice virtue, tame your mind. These are the sayings of the Buddha. You are a Buddhist already.
Mm. Well, this has been interesting. I didn't realize how deep Buddhism was. And I keep Buddhism. There we go. Buddhism. Buddhism. It's been a long day already. You know, and knowing that you've practiced many different other styles and traditions, can you just quickly maybe relate like any part of Buddhism to conjuring, to any sort of magical practicing that most people are used to seeing, like the magic, the spell work, the candle work, or craft, anything like that?
On a physical level, Buddhists, especially Tibetan Buddhists, we do have charms. Like I mentioned earlier, we have sungkor. There's also something called a zi bead. They're made from meteorite. The real ones are very rare anymore. Mm-hmm. And those are often used in what are called blessing pills. And those are usually made by high lamas. They're given their own empowerment. They have very sacred abilities. It's said that when you're dying, if you were to take one of these, if someone places it in your mouth, even if you're already gone, you go through the bardo much quicker and attain a much better birth. I have blessing pills both from the Dalai Lama, which were given to me by the woman who creates the namkas that I have, when she met him in Dharamsala. And I also have blessing pills from the Karmapa, which I received after my Nyunye retreat. So we have, for lack of a better word, talismans. We have amulets, just like in conjuring and brujeria, you have amuletos, you have gligli, and you have mojo bags. We use fire and we use lamps to dispel darkness and to imitate our prayers, just like you have the lighting of candles and novenas and brujeria and in conjure to manifest change. On more ideological levels, in conjure, you're awakening certain spirits, whether they're from the cemetery or they're from certain plants. And in Tibetan Buddhism, when we work with the archetypes that we work with, when we work with the yidam, the meditational deities we work with, we awaken those energies, not only in our own mind stream and in our own bodies, but in the energies that are surround us, in our family, in the land, in even in other people, if they're present. You know, when we did the Nyunye retreat, that is a retreat to Chinrezig, there were people. It's funny, we did this retreat in a Catholic kind of retreat center.
Mm-hmm.
And so the receptionist and everyone up there were hearing, you know, the drum being played, the bells being rang. We had conches, but we didn't use them. You know, they're hearing all of this. At the end of retreat, I went up and I was waiting. Like on the final day, I went up after retreat, after we were done, after we gave the vows back and everything. We went up there, or I went up there. I was waiting. And the woman at the desk was, "What were you guys doing?" And I told her. And she goes, "Interesting. It has not been very stressful for work during this whole time you guys were down there." So I have never received the empowerment. I'm not sure who has received the empowerment of my fellow retreatants, but just us being there and us for 3 days straight adhering to vows strictly and keeping our mind in a certain frame, even though we would leave that same building every night and come back, affected some kind of change just within the other sentient beings that were surrounding us at that time.
That's really neat. That's really cool. You know, there's a lot of what you've been saying that I can kind of like, that's similar to the shamanism. That's similar to some of the other stuff. And I think there's a lot of similarities between a lot of the different practices and religions, just slightly different names or slightly different ways of doing it. But I do love that you're bringing to mind or to the forefront that Buddhism isn't just, and I'm saying this again, sit there, wear a pretty mala, and recite mantras over and over again, you know, there's a lot more to it. And there's a lot of underlying energy work going on that I don't think people realized either, which is why I'm like, let's talk about the mysticism and Buddhism for everybody to have an understanding. So I appreciate and thank you for bringing that forth. And it's already been over an hour, believe it or not. We talk a lot.
Yeah.
Was there anything else you wanted to maybe say that if you had notes that we didn't go over or before we wrap it up? That's one thing, like you're always meticulous in your notes and your teachings and you give people when we have classes. That's why I'm like, I'm sure he's got more.
Oh, I do, but this would take up a whole other hour. So
we'll have to do a part two.
Yeah. One of the other things I do want to say is that magic does exist in Tibetan Buddhism, and it exists throughout all forms of Buddhism, actually. As much as many people think it's just about the mind, it very much is about the mind. But there are tools that exist outside of us that help us fix what's inside of us in Tantra and in, well, I shouldn't say Tantra so much as it's in the Terama teachings of Tibetan Buddhism, where things like Dzogchen and Mahamudra come from. There's a lot of talk about outer, inner, and secret obstacles, and outer and inner and secret development, and outer and inner and secret offerings. And a lot of people come to, for whatever reason, this idea that if there's a problem outside of me, all I have to do is fix what's inside of me. Sure, that is helpful, but that does not negate nor invalidate outer obstacles.
Hmm.
Outer obstacles are just as valid as inner obstacles, and when you get into the higher teachings, secret obstacles. So just because something isn't going right or how you want it to go, it could be your perception. It could be something that you have to fix inside of you. but it could very well as it could very well just as much be something outside of you. In the New Agey and in the most, you know, quote unquote spiritual communities and circles, it's always, well, what's wrong inside of you? Let's do some work inside of you. And we do forget there are outer problems.
Mm-hmm.
It isn't always look inside to find the answer. Sometimes you have to deal with things outside of yourself. They're just as valid.
There are other people with their intentions and their things to learn, and sometimes it spills over to you.
Yeah, and so that is the interconnection of karma. A lot of people also think, you know, karma, especially in the West, karma is this, you do good, you get good. You do bad, you get bad. No. You could do as much good in this world right now, but because of karma, you're still doing penance for things eons ago. Lama Lina, actually, in one of her teachings, said, it might not even be you. As a human, you have other things living on and inside of you. She used the analogy of Hitler could be one of the bugs in your gut. He did horrible things. It wouldn't surprise me if he came back into this life as a gut bug. So it might not even be you. It could be something of some other living thing inside of you, or your pet has to go through its karma. The animals are one of the realms of existence. And so, you know, it has you to deal with that. So, you know, the land you live on has karmic connections. And my teacher even went on about Trump and that whole presidency and our past as Americans and the things that we are now having to deal with karmically because of it. You know, the way karma acts, it's so interconnected with everything else. And a lot of people just don't really fully conceptualize it, and they just like to boil it down to you do bad, you get bad, you do good, you get good. It is not just that. You live out karma every day that you wake up, or even if you don't wake up, then you got to deal with it your next incarnation.
I think our one line takeaway from this whole recording now is Hitler is a stomach bug.
Yes.
That's going to be our one liner now.
And some beings, this could be a good thing. Some very enlightened beings can do this, and some not so blessed beings could do this. You could be incarnated in multiple realms right now, or in multiple parts of this realm, making up for karmic problems from forever ago.
Maybe that's why I'm so tired all the time. That's my story and I'm sticking to it. All right. Well, since we're over an hour, I think we both have some more to do to our day. So, but it sounds like we need to do a part two, or maybe even a part three on, like, maybe just one on karma and how it really truly works. Cause I think there's some misconception and not full understanding on karma.
Oh yeah.
You know, so we'll have to discuss some times to record some extra Buddhism part two.
Yeah.
But thanks for enlightening us on the mysticism in Buddha and or Buddhism. There we go. I'll get it right eventually. Guess who's in charge of the editing? This person. We're gonna take all those out or leave them in. Who knows? But thanks for sharing with us.
Thank you for having me.